from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. When he was a little boy, Glenn Washington's family moved from Detroit to the Michigan countryside. He remembers his first day of school.
I was ready to go. First day. The bus stopped, packed with screaming kids, hollering, noisy. I stepped on, looked down the row of seats, and everything got quiet. Real, real quiet. See, we were the only black folk for miles around.
That's an excerpt from Glenn Washington's Oakland-based public radio show, Snap Judgment. Glenn Washington joins us next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, in today for Michael Krasny. The trajectory of Glenn Washington's first 40-some years goes something like this. Born in Detroit, raised in rural Michigan, a black kid whose family happened to belong to a white supremacist cult, college, few years in Japan, law school, runs nonprofits, followed by, somehow not surprisingly, winning a public radio talent contest. So it's understandable that Glenn Washington has a few stories to tell. And that's what he now does as the creator and host of the Oakland-based public radio program Snap Judgment, which airs on some 200 public radio stations around the country, including KALW and KQED in San Francisco. He joins us this morning as part of our first-person interview series where we feature the individuals, innovators, leaders, and compelling characters who make the Bay Area unique. Glenn Washington, good morning.
Good morning, Dave. Great to be on the show.
It's a pleasure to have you here. So how did you come to this? I just sort of traced very quickly this mercurial life career pattern of yours, which somehow landed in entering a public radio talent contest. Why did you enter? What was it that drew you to doing that?
Well, you know, I think I'm like a lot of your listeners, Dave. I am a public radio head. It's one of those things that my roommates used to tease me about, running around the house with headphones on. So, and a lot of public radio people, audience members, we feel an ownership of public radio. We're the ones who write the checks. And when you write a check, you feel like this is part of you. This is part of, I own a piece of this. And as much as I love public media, some of it drove me up a wall. And so I figured, when I heard about the Public Radio Talent Quest, I heard about it the night before the entries were due. And I thought, well, you know what? If I want to preserve my right to complain, and which is the same reason why you write a check sometimes, preserve your right to complain. You can't complain if you're not part of the team. And so the night before the entry was due, I told a story to my daughter and recorded that and sent it in and forgot about it.
And then?
And then 3 months later, I received a phone call. I was eating at a Chinese restaurant in Berkeley, and it was Jake Shapiro and Izzy Smith from PRX. They called and said, "Oh, I got
that's the Public Radio Exchange."
Public Radio Exchange. They called and said, "You know, is this Glenn Washington? We'd like to congratulate you. You won. You're one of 10 finalists for this contest." And frankly, I thought it was my buddy Mark playing a joke. I wasn't really thinking about the contest. Man, you know, stop playing. What are you talking about? No, this is, you know, just Jake. Congratulations. So then I was really excited.
What is it about public radio that bugged you? And then we'll get to sort of what you've tried to develop and the purpose of your program. But what was it about public radio that just you found annoying? It drove you up the wall.
Well, Dave, I oftentimes didn't see my communities reflected in public media. I didn't see my intonations respected. I didn't see my people represented. And I say that very, very, very broadly. Public radio does a great job of hitting a certain segment of the population. If you are an educated white man over the age of 47 in this country, you listen to public media. But there's lots of other groups that are part of the public. And are just as smart, just as engaged, just as willing to tell their own stories, and just as interesting to listen to. And I think a big problem that I had is that I don't think that my America needs translation. And what I mean by that is that if someone tells me a story, I don't necessarily need someone with the King's English to translate the story that someone just told me. Again, I live in this country. I can understand a lot of different people from a lot of different backgrounds. And the thing of it is that most of public media audiences are this way. We listen to public media, number one, because everything else is imbecilic. And you can't, you know, you really couldn't, you're not going to turn off an NPR show and listen to someone prattling on about nonsense. But there's something about being able to hear people who provide a perspective on your world that public media people, they love this exploration. They love to sit on someone's shoulder. They love to see the world through someone else's eyes.
We're going to hear exactly what you're talking about in an excerpt from one of your programs in just a second. But to set that up, tell me something about the concept of what you then tried to create, to provide us with that voice, the idea of snap judgments and how that gets at the kind of picture and personality and voice and experience that hasn't been part of public radio.
One of the things that one of the journeys we wanted to take people on was a journey of perspective. How can we make an experience such that you actually feel it? We love to talk to your head, but we really are aiming at your heart, because I know from my own experience that when I watch Frontline and see two people screaming at each other, I don't feel compelled to do anything after I see something like that. Different political perspective, da 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 da. I don't feel anything. But when I hear a story that takes me somewhere, that puts me in someone's brain and their heart, then at the end of it, I feel like I've lived a bit of someone else's life, and I feel that I have a little taste of their perspective, and it moves me to. It's all about empathy, I think. And that's, if I could say anything, there's lots of things that we want to do with Snap Judgment, but we really wanted to provide, we want you to feel the perspective of someone else who may be very, very different from you, and not see it as foreign.
Let's listen. This is an excerpt from the Snap Judgment program called Close Knit.
Okay, so my dear friend was pregnant. Everybody was excited. But then the doctor said, something's wrong. They put her on bed rest. And for my friend, this was not easy. But she was going to do everything she could. They told her not to move. So she didn't move. But then she started having these pains. And her water broke. Too early. Way too early. Months too early. But the baby had to come out. Premature. Mother and child were whisked to a neonatal intensive unit, and only parents were allowed to visit. I was not a parent. But the daddy was on the other side of the world trying to find a plane, and my friend said, I need someone here. So when the nurse asked me, are you the daddy?
Are you the daddy?
I told her, yeah, I'm the daddy. And the nurse, she told me to scrub my hands with soap and the special brush before she took me to the incubator. And she looked like a little baby bird, hooked to tubes and wires and monitors, so, so tiny. My friend, the child's mother, took my hand. I told her to go to sleep. Go on to sleep. Are you sure? Go to sleep. She finally left, and the nurses told me that what a tiny baby under 2 pounds really needs is skin-on-skin contact. What can I do? They told me to strip. They set up a tent, an anti-contamination tent, and sent me wearing nothing but my boxer shorts inside. The monitors kept beeping and beeping, rhythmic. The nurse picked up this little baby and her little mouth opened. The monitors went crazy, alarms, red, flashing, shrill, loud. I have never been more scared. Then she put that tiny baby on my chest and all those noisy monitors, all that crazy calamity. Calm down. Calm down to a heartbeat. Her heartbeat. Skin to skin. She felt so soft. She looked so beautiful. I thought I had lied when I told the nurses she was mine. I looked down and saw her and knew whatever the biology right then. For that moment, she was mine. And you know what? When I see her now, riding her bike with that big old horsey laugh, and I ask, who's your favorite? I don't care who she says. I don't care because I already know.
An excerpt from Snap Judgment, the story Close Knit. It does so what you described about making you feel something. And it also is a story that you're telling, even though I know you wrote that out, even though I know I bet you recorded that and rewrote it and re-edited many times.
No, Dave. I just dashed that off the top of my head.
But that's what I'm interested in, because it feels like you're telling that story. It feels like what you just described earlier about telling a story to your daughter.
Yeah, we really do try to make intimate. You know, radio is just such an intimate medium. And we if we're doing our job right, hopefully a lot of the art, the hard work is lost. So hopefully you don't see it. The producer on that piece, Pat Messini Miller, it's one of the things I say. If you want to make great art, collaborate with a bunch of geniuses and then show up and take the credit. Pat and C.D. Miller arranged that piece. I work with just this team of just stunning storytellers. And from my partner, Mark Ristich, to the entire Snap crew, we're a small, tiny crew. But those guys, they work really, really hard to make sure that you don't see the art.
You said a moment just now who arranged that piece, which is a musical term, arrangement. Say something, if you would, Glenn, about the role of music and storytelling and the way in which that pulls at the heart.
Yeah. The thing of it is this, our show was built, I think, for a next generation listener. What really brought me to public media in the first place was probably This American Life. It was a show that I still love, and I'm really thankful actually to Ira for a lot of his support. But what we were trying to do was make our stories as tight as they could be and still have the intelligence that public radio listeners demand. And that meant that we're telling stories on two different tracks at the same time. The musical, or should I say the soundscaping track, ends up helping us get the information across at the same time the storyteller is speaking, and allows us to have much shorter stories that can contain the same amount of information, that we're cueing you in on mood and on place by how we're soundscaping.
And you're also so interested in this question of choices that you make, that in this moment you made this Snap decision to be the daddy. Why are you so interested in exploring those moments? What does that reveal about human experience?
It's these pressure points that I think reveal the person. There has never been a story, at least a story that I want to listen to, that at some point somebody had to say, you know what, I'm doing this. And what we're trying to do at Snap is just get rid of the exposition, get rid of all the other stuff, and get right to the heart of what that decision was, who the person was made it, and what the ramifications were. And that's really, I mean, it's a bit of a stretch to say, the fact of the matter is this is a term of art. Every single story. There's not a story that you love, there's not a movie that you want to see that doesn't have someone at some point saying, I'm doing this.
Let's listen to another. This is from a program called Absolution about forgiveness. And it's a story about called Back of the Bus, about your growing up in Michigan. To set the stage for us, you grew up in Detroit and then?
Yeah, I was born into Detroit in the late 60s, early 70s. And it was crazy. My parents were really deeply religious people, and they decided that this was no place to raise a young family, and they moved us out.
So we'll pick up the story there as you're waiting for the school bus.
I should say this. I moved from the city to very rural Michigan. I was born in Detroit, Michigan, right? And when I was a little kid, we moved out to the middle of nowhere. We got a big plot of land and called ourselves farmers. And on the first day of school, I stood by the side of the road waiting for this rickety school bus to stop. I had that hopeful first day of school feeling you get, my little backpack, my little trapper keeper, you know. I was ready to go, first day. The bus stopped, packed with screaming kids, hollering, noisy. I stepped on, looked down the row of seats, and everything got quiet. Real, real quiet. See, we were the only black folk for miles around. Every seat could hold two people, and I went to sit down right next to this little toe-headed boy, and he spit in the seat right where I was going to sit. I kept walking down the aisle, and every open seat, someone spit, daring me to sit in it. And the bus driver's like,
"Hurry up. Hurry up and sit yourself down."
And I kept walking further and further toward the back of the bus. I'm running out of options. Big, big globules of saliva. They're waiting for me in every seat.
I said, "Sit yourself behind one of them seats."
And I get to the very back of the bus, the very last seat, and there's a little girl about my age sitting with her backpack in the empty seat. And I can't turn back around. I can't turn back around. I do not know what to do. And the little girl moves her backpack, slides it to the floor, and I sit down. I don't say a word. She doesn't say a word to me. We ride. And the next day, I walk past the leering, the shouting, the hollering to the back of the bus. And Mary Jo, I know her name is Mary Jo now. She moves her bag, and I sit down.
The first part of that story, we'll get to the second in a moment. Did you always remember that moment when that backpack was moved and you sat down?
Yeah. I think that because we move so often, that, you know, that those first days of school in different areas, those first days in a new place, those are always going to be frozen in your memory. And this, you know, this was the first day. I'm excited, you know, I wanted to, you know, do well in school, and this is what happened. And yeah, I can remember this like it was yesterday.
So let's continue with the story. The bus route changes, and you become now the child who gets picked up first. So you're waiting in a full bus when you get to the little girl's home.
This is rural Michigan. Nobody's rich, but some of us are really poor. Really poor. And if you are a really poor family living in some mobile home in Michigan, in the middle of winter, there's a good chance your water pipes would freeze. Not enough insulation. And this means when you're getting ready for school, you don't have any water. No bathing. And when you're in this situation, you've got two choices. Neither of them good. You can go on to school, stinking of whatever chores you had to do around your little farm, or you could try to mask the smell under cheap perfume. On this day, Mary Jo went the perfume route. And when she got on the bus, the stink was like someone slapped you in the face. It smelled like rotting flowers pressed on top of barn filth. Everyone started hollering. She kind of held up her head and looked toward the back of the bus. I looked right at her. She looked right back at me, and I turned my head away as if I didn't know her. I hoped she would get the hint. I hoped she wouldn't come all the way back, because
It would just come to me. I wanted her to sit with someone else. I just wished everyone would stop screaming. Then she was there, looking at my seat with my backpack blocking her, just looking. And for a moment, for a long moment, I looked straight ahead. Then I was so ashamed. I was so ashamed of myself. I moved my backpack to the ground, and she sat down right next to me. And we rode. And we didn't say anything. The bus kids turned around to hold their noses and scream at her. And they screamed at me sitting next to her. And you know, for the first time, I didn't care. I didn't care what anybody thought. I didn't care if they punched or spit or swung. I didn't care. I just wanted to say something to her. I wanted to say, I'm sorry. Instead, I said, hey, my name's Glenn. And Mary Jo said, I know your name. And we talked. Two little kids in the back of the bus. We just talked.
Do you think you just knew that you were forgiven in that moment? Did that happen just by saying, hey, I'm Glenn?
Yeah. I'm recalling this as best I can, obviously, for the story, but I don't think, especially when you're a little kid, you're just like, do you forgive me now? Why, yes, I do. That's not really how it goes down. It's more of a feeling. It's more of a nod, and I think that's what happened.
And in that show, which is about that topic, what did you learn from people's stories about the importance of that, about of absolution, as the program is called?
You know, every single story, it we try to have stories that surprise ourselves about what absolution means to one person is completely different from someone else. And with almost all of our topics, we're continually surprised. I think that's what makes the show so much fun to work on, is that if you surprise us, if you surprise us with where you're going with the story, we know that this is going to be something special that's really going to engage the audiences. And this happened again and again, especially in this episode.
And we have to go to a break, but it also is such a powerful reminder of how those little moments make a difference, that you move the backpack, that you say, hey, my name is Glenn.
Yeah. The stories... You know, people think that to get on Snap Judgment, you have to have some crazy pirate ship rocket launcher story. And that's oftentimes the opposite of the case. Those small moments really do make the narrative.
Glenn Washington, our guest. His program, Snap Judgment, airs on 200 public radio stations nationwide. Here on KQED, it's Saturday night at 11 on KALW. It's Wednesdays at 1 o'clock and Sundays at 2. When we return, we'll hear more excerpts from the program Snap Judgment. We'd like to hear from you as well, your own stories about those moments that you remembered when something changed for you and the consequence of that decision. 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also post your story if you want on our website or on our Facebook page, or email it to us at kqed.org. More with Glenn Washington and more about Snap Judgment when we return. This is Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our guest this hour, Glenn Washington. His public radio program, Snap Judgment, airs on 200 stations around the country, here locally on KQED on Saturday nights, on KALW Wednesdays at 1 and Sundays at 2. It's based in Oakland, and you know, when we started out, Glenn, you were telling me something about how you wanted to add something to public radio. Is part of what you're adding Oakland? Is that part of what public radio needs?
It is so true. In the same way that Boston is the milieu for car talk and that Minnesota is the home of Prairie Home, we find our home base in Oakland. And it's in these lines between ethnicities and cultures
You know, there's 130 languages spoken within like four blocks of our office. And whenever you have different ethnicities and different cultures mixing it up, you always get great food and great stories. And we can throw a microphone outside the window and see what happens as far as storytelling.
Let's hear from some of our listeners who want to talk to you this morning. 866-733-6786 is the number if you'd like to talk with Glenn Washington. If you have a story you want to tell, 866-733-6786. Zach in San Francisco is first. Zach, go ahead, please.
Good morning. Glenn, I just wanted to thank you very, very much. You are the best storyteller, and I love your music that accompanies your delivery. And also I wanted to say, please check out the interview that Terry Gross did today with Chris Rock. And I was wondering, how often do you do live shows? I know that you perform at the Brava Theater now and then.
Yeah, we're going to have a new season of live storytelling coming up probably in the spring. And thank you for the kind words. But I think you're really going to dig some of the storytelling we've got up. We're going to really push the live storytelling over the next year.
Well, let's hear an example, actually, of a live example. This is from an occasional TV version of Snap Judgment that you do. And it's also a way of getting into your family story, which I'd like to explore a little bit of as well. So this is from the TV version of Snap Judgment, and it's about heading to a family reunion.
My mother has a huge family. And every year, they have a family reunion. And she's always trying to get me to go. Come on, let's go. I haven't gone since I was a little kid. Finally, she wore me down. All right, let's go. And actually, it was cool. 1,000 black folk. Every one of them with a gap in their front teeth. It was getting our family reunion on, you know, bean bagging and horseshoes. It's a 3-day affair, and my mama said, look ahead. You got a cousin that lived up in Malaysia. You lived in Malaysia. I want you to go talk to her right away. I'm busy, mama. You know, a couple days go by. I need you to go talk to your cousin. All right, I'm going to talk to my cousin. 50 million cousins here. I'm going to talk to this one. I go over there. She's right over the hill. Get over there. All right. How you doing? What's going on, La? Bahasa Malaya, La? And she's like, I don't speak none of that nonsense. My mom tells me you lived in Malaysia. Did you have a good time over there? Better still, I got a question for you. Have you accepted the Lord Jesus Christ as your personal savior? Well, you know what? My religion is kind of complicated. And, you know, I'm just live and let live right now. We're just in the middle of this family reunion. I asked you a question. Have you accepted the Lord Jesus Christ as your personal savior? It was real nice meeting you. I'm going to go stand over here now.
Ah, family reunions. You grew up in an unusual circumstance in that you wound up, your family was quite religious, and you became members of, I don't know what to call it, other than an interesting cult with interesting views on race and fabulous storytelling.
Yeah. You know, I hated growing up. I grew up in a very fundamentalist, Jesus-oriented white supremacist cult, which is kind of strange for a black family, as you
yeah.
can imagine. And it was, I guess I should add the word apocalyptic, because I think a lot of my current leanings towards storytelling came from that kind of apocalyptic side of things, because when you say that Jesus is going to be here any minute, you're going to be here, you know, don't make any long-term plans because Jesus is coming. And if Jesus doesn't show up, you've got some explaining to do. And it happened again and again. You know, I remember one of these times when I was a kid, this is a quote from one of our ministers. And if you think we're going to make it out of the 1980s without seeing the Lord Jesus Christ, you got another thing coming, mister. And that's, we were on the edge of our seats waiting for Jesus all the time. And that does tend to enhance your storytelling ability when you listen to that all the time.
And you also have said that going to law school enhanced your storytelling ability, that it taught you that whoever tells the best story wins. So it's a pretty fascinating combination of storytelling generation, apocalyptic religion and law school.
It is a shame. And if you are in trouble with the law, hire the best storyteller. That's for sure. Someone who can hit the heart. And it's one of those terrible things you learn in law school, is like all that black letter law stuff and all that sort of thing. A lot of that goes out of the window when you see how decisions are actually made.
You know, what just occurred to me, I don't know why, but it's the great line, if the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit.
Again, a perfect storyteller. No, there's no better storyteller than Johnny Cochran. Hire him, pay him what he wants, because he's gonna save you.
Let's go to Tim in San Francisco. Tim, go ahead, please.
Hey, a couple of years ago, I had to make a really big decision in my life. I was diagnosed as being bipolar, and of course, the crazy person is always the last one to know that they're crazy. And when I was diagnosed with this, I had to make the decision whether I thought that I needed to take the medication or that the doctor was wrong. And after living 38 years with this mental illness, of course, I saw the world as being crazy, and I was not. So I made the decision that I was mentally ill. I had a very extreme case of being bipolar, and I had to make the decision whether I wanted to take the medication for it. And I decided to, and the medication profoundly changed the way that I live my life. And I'm also an artist, and when you are bipolar, you see things completely in a different perspective. And it brought me to a place where I wasn't seeing things the way I used to, and my art wasn't, my photography wasn't the same as it used to be. So I had to make the decision whether to keep taking the medication, where it changed my life for the better in so many other places, but where my art had to change also. That was probably the biggest and hardest decision I ever had to make in my life.
And what did you decide, Tim?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
What did you decide?
You know what? I decided to keep taking the medication, and my art did not suffer. It just changed forms. And I'm still producing great artwork, and people are still coming to me and looking at my work and admiring what I do. And I take that as a huge compliment. So after 2 years of being on this medication, I actually have a brain that can go quiet and I can listen. It's not going 1,000 miles a minute at every second of the day.
And let me hold you there, Tim. Your line's breaking up a bit, and we have, the heart of your story. And thank you so much for sharing it with us. You get stories like Tim's all the time, Glenn?
We do. And the things that move the person that is going through this experience, we really do try hard to put listeners in the head of someone who might be experiencing these types of challenges. And, when we do it right, hopefully, Tim, we've actually had my brother, who suffered from some mental challenges, when we've used his stories and we've done it right, hopefully we're able to provide a window into some of the decision-making that you've had to do.
Tim, thanks again for the call. Josephine in San Jose is next. Josephine.
I'm one of the older KQED listeners, and when I first heard Snap Judgment, I was really interested in the story that was being told, and I wanted to listen, but the sound effects just drove me crazy, and I got so I just couldn't stay with the program, and I thought, you know, the sound effects were overkill, and I hadn't listened, but hearing these stories that you just had on the radio now, the sound effects, you know, were much less invasive, and I enjoyed the stories thoroughly. So I guess that's just something to think about, that the overabundance of the sound effects can get in the way of the story, and maybe that was just at the beginning. There were the, you know, overkill as far as I was concerned, but now I'm ready to go back and try to listen to the program again.
Great, Josephine. Thanks. See, every public radio listener has the ability and power to state their view.
Call up, cuss us out, Josephine. I don't like it. Change it up.
Josephine, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Sean next in San Francisco. Sean, go ahead.
Well, you know, first of all, I'm a public radio head. I'm down here cleaning my garage, listening to switch between the two public radio stations here. Yesterday, I cleaned my whole house in anticipation of my kids returning home on Monday. Second thing I want to mention is that the whole idea of snap judgment and how it affects, well, at least how the program and I relate, in that when I first, sometimes I have a hard time sleeping at night in public radio. It's just great to, you know, start thinking about something
to put
else.
You to sleep.
Well, it helps me go to sleep because it stops, gets me off of what I'm thinking that's keeping me awake. And occasionally snap judgment would come on, and I hear the accent, you know, and I make these judgments, oh, it's going to be rap music or it's going to be something I'm not interested in, and I switch to channel. So eventually what happened is, again, the program came on, and this time it was a program about a woman who I guess was an escort who ended up going to Saudi Arabia. So it became a little titillating, and as a result, I want to hear this and, you know, tongue hanging out of my mouth waiting for all these details. And what happened in the end is two things. One, it wasn't what I expected. It was better than I expected. It was just totally involved me. And secondly, my initial assumption about what the program would be was completely wrong. And since then, I've been an addict to your program, watching it, hearing it online when I can, or trying to catch it on radio. And I just think it's probably one of the best programs that I get to listen to. And I'm totally grateful to have the opportunity to do it. And thank you.
Sean, thank you.
Thank you so much for letting us know.
That's great to hear from you, Sean. Say something, if you would, more, Glenn, about the element of surprise and twists within a story and how you go about crafting those. Because Sean is saying that the story took him where he didn't think he was going to go.
Yeah. Now, let's just, you know, be frank. All of our stories are not something that necessarily needs to be broadcast on radio or on TV. And we are looking for stories that do take us places that we don't expect. And again, I can just, my small and dedicated staff has a really good ear for, you know, stories, perspectives, and ideas that you don't expect. We look for it in a storytelling show. And it's, but the thing of it is we're nowhere near running out. One of the things that people were saying when we first started this show was like, oh, well, I don't know if this is going to have legs. And the very last thing we have to worry about is enough stories. People have lived these amazing lives. And if we can actually boil down what they're saying into 7 minutes, you can really, they're going to rock and roll.
Thomas in Jenner wants to add his thoughts. Thomas, go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to mention the power of stories. I think that they really run our consciousness in the world and the government. Right now, we're living in a country where, despite the fact that Bush cut taxes years ago and unemployment skyrocketed, we have a large amount of the electorate believing the story that if you cut taxes on the super rich, then they'll hire more people, when we're just experienced the exact opposite. But that story is so well crafted. It has a plot, it has a result, it has all these key story elements that people swallow it, despite their fact that they're unemployed, you know, right after these giant tax cuts that Bush did.
Thanks, Thomas. It's an interesting point about the power of stories. Stories don't have to be true to be powerful, as Thomas suggests. It's also, of course, the power of advertising. The best ads tell a story.
Yeah. And what's interesting, too, I think from our perspective, is that, you know, we were speaking earlier about how a lot of political advertising is oftentimes shrill. And I think that what we're trying to do, I think what public media does best, is tell stories that don't, that allow you to get into a perspective without having to be an advocate on one side or another and just look at the reality. I don't think that most clear thinking necessarily falls down into one political perspective or another or one ethnic group or another. I think that when you allow yourself to hear the fullness of what a person's experience is, it gives you a real good idea these stories do in fact inform policy. One of the things that we've had to deal with a lot is that because the show is national, I think that some of the Bay Area listeners might not appreciate the fact that we, of course, treat people of different sexual orientations as if they are people, which is a big, you know, maybe shocker in different areas. But what's great is that we can have a show about a Bay Area transsexual, and that story can play in Mississippi. And because we're just telling a straight version of that own person's experiences, we don't get any pushback from there. The empathy is there, even in areas where you wouldn't expect it to be. And that's really important for us.
Let's listen to another story that isn't one of yours, because I want to make sure we give listeners who may not have listened to your show before that your voice is one voice among many. There are stories from many people around the country who contribute their own experiences. This is a story called, we're just going to listen to the first few minutes of it, but it's a story called Embryonic, and that's all I'll say.
We thought we're going to go for it, and however it turns out, we'll be okay with that. If it works, great. We'll have four kids. Perfect. If it doesn't work, we're fine with our family the way it is. We went in for that frozen embryo transfer, and we transferred three embryos. 10 days after the frozen embryo transfer, I was scheduled to go and have a blood draw for a pregnancy test, and I waited that day for a phone call confirming. Now, I have to tell you, I knew in my heart I already was. I had all of the symptoms. I just knew it had worked. I knew it. I'm already thinking of names. How am I going to set up our house? So when the call did not come, 1 o'clock passed, 2 o'clock passed, 3 o'clock passed, no call. I figured they'd call for sure by the end of the day. So that's why when my husband, Sean, kind of barreled through our door at about 4 o'clock that afternoon, I was stunned. He said that the doctor had informed him that indeed I was pregnant, but that there had been a mistake and that they had thawed and transferred the embryos of another couple. So I was indeed pregnant with somebody else's genetic child. Well, I was shocked. I think when anyone undergoes some sort of a fertility treatment, you expect one of two things to happen. Either it's going to work and you're pregnant, or it didn't work and you're disappointed. The idea that you could be pregnant with somebody else's child never even entered into the realm of possibility for me. The doctor explained that he needed to know what our intentions were. Very quickly, within moments of learning of the situation, we knew what we had to do. That was care for this child during the pregnancy and do our best we could to protect him or her, and then deliver him or her back to his genetic parents upon delivery, because that's what we would have wanted someone to do for us.
Boy, talk about a decision with consequences.
Yeah.
And a surprise.
And a surprise. And the surprises keep coming.
Right.
You know, and these things happen all the time. I'm not sure that does not happen all the time. Be aware. But the stories that these people have to face, they're stunning. And these stunning decisions that change their lives forever. Like I said, we're not going to run out of these.
I will just complete one part of the story, which is that she does have the child. The child returns to their biological parents. Then she decides to have another child, and I'll just leave it at that. You can go listen to
snapjudgment.org
and find the rest of that story. It's a great story. Gabrielle in Oakland is next with a comment. Gabrielle, go ahead, please.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Snap Judgment, in addition to being local, is one of the most fantastic shows on public radio, and KQED should air it at a better time. I usually have to listen to it on my computer because 11 o'clock on Saturday just isn't a convenient time. And I want to recommend that instead of replaying Car Talk for the second time on Sunday, that would be a great time slot for Snap Judgment.
Preach, Gabrielle. Preach.
Gabrielle, thank you. Thanks for the call. And we should also point out in sort of equal affirmative action orientation here that you can also listen to it on KALW Wednesdays at 1, Sundays at 2. So you do have other alternatives, and we'll see what KQED may do in the future. Here's a comment from Joe on our website. The school bus story you told reminded me of the experiences I had as a kid growing up in Pennsylvania in a dominantly white town. Experiences like that aren't easy to relive even 10, 20, or 30 years later. Props to you for having the courage to lay that down. I hadn't really thought about that. Going back to that moment for you, going back to these turning point moments, what has that been like?
You know, for those stories, sometimes it is hard, actually, especially when they're personal family stories. Sometimes my family wasn't the Brady Bunch. But some of the things I think that any storyteller will tell you, I know we have some of our team right now working on a story that has to do with potential pedophilia. And trying to craft that in a way that's appropriate for public media, it means that you have to spend a good deal of time in darkness. And it's one of those things where sometimes I'm very, very happy this is a weekly show instead of maybe a movie where I'd have to live there for a period of time, because it can be really, really tough. When you're making these stories, you are, in a sense, you're living in those areas. You're living with those decisions. And so you'll find a lot of dark stories, but hopefully a lot more light than darkness on the Snap.
Hugh in Oakland. Go ahead, Hugh.
Hi, I'd originally called with the same request for an earlier time, but while I was waiting, you mentioned the interculturalism of Oakland, looking out the window from your offices, and it reminded me of one of the stories you did actually during your interview process, and one of the reasons that I actually voted for you from Oakland.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And it was about a young African-American man, a boy actually, I believe, around 12 years old or something of the sort, who had learned Mandarin Chinese or something. And it was just inspirational that this young man would take it upon himself to follow his, his curiosity. And especially in a time when we hear so many negative impressions of young African American men in Oakland, how inspirational that was. And to follow up, if you could just follow up on that, whether you followed up with that young man, tell us a little bit about the story, and if you will have other positive peer pressure stories for young African-American men.
Hugh, thank you. Thank you so much. I'm just going to segue slightly and we'll come back to Hugh's question because we just have a couple of minutes. Can you tell us that story? What a great way to end, to have Glenn Washington just tell us a story.
Absolutely. This was a story. This is when we were first, before we actually had a show, this is when we were applying to do it in the contest. And I read about a young man by the name of Tyler Thompson, and he was, I believe, 11 or 12 years old at the time. And what he was doing, he was cited in the Wall Street Journal for singing Chinese opera. And again, this is a perfect Oakland story, an Oakland idea. And when I met him, you know, he was a kid. He just didn't really care too much about what his friends thought about him singing in this, you know, and he got teased about it. Chinese opera, what are you doing? But he had a teacher who gave him a lot of support, and his intonation was really, really good. He could actually do it. He didn't know Mandarin, but he could sing it, and he did it, and he got a lot of acclaim for it. I saw a picture of him with Condoleezza Rice after that later on. So it took him to a world stage, and I saw him just a few weeks ago on the street. He's going to the Oakland School of Arts right downtown, very near Snap Judgment, and gave him a big hug then. He's a musician of some sort, still following his own dreams.
And what's the next story you want to tell?
The next story. I'm about to go into seclusion. Dave, I'm going to seclusion. I'm going to write a stage show. And right now it's called Conversations with God. And there are so many stories in my own life that bump up against my own exploration of what it means to be divine, to experience divinity, to someone who's not religious, to what does it mean to know wonder and awe and put it in a perspective that I think it's really going to be compelling to a lot of public radio listeners. I think you're really, really going to dig this, but I've got to get into this hole. This writing thing is sometimes painful. And my wife, she's wonderful. She's giving me a little time. I'm going off I'm going to strap myself to a chair and not get up for a week until this thing is written.
Well, come back out again, will you?
I will. Thank you so much. I appreciate you having us on forum.
Glenn Washington. The program is Snap Judgment. Pleasure to have you on our air right now. Pleasure to have you as part of public radio. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dave.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Tina Lorberg, and Amanda Stupai. Our engineer today, Howard Gelman. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Dave Iverson, in for Michael Krasny. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.